wherein we discuss the narrations from the companions of Prophet Muhammad from the Sunni sources, obviously. Then we analyzed them in two parts. The first part was where the fact was only mentioned that his name is like my name. There was not the mention of the father's name. And then when it talks about Imam, it says his name is like my name and his father's name is like my name. And interestingly, the Sunni scholars themselves reject the claim and say the chain of narrations is quite weak. And interestingly, Sunni scholars say that this claim is not true and it's about the chain of narrations on analyzing was quite weak. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Thank you so much to your listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its east rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June the 30th, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. In the ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond. And in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office. A decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the UN session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the UN. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then UN Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December 1, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the Prime Minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the prime minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sote. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends. The and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. And we are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. 9 African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002, the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, profitability with abundant giving to the neighbors. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of profitability with abundant giving to the neighbors in the Islamic lifestyle. In this part of episode, we will talk about the rights of the neighbors and the ethics that we must have in relation to our neighbors. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has said, وَلَعَوْدِ عَلَيْهِمْ بِالْجِدَّةِ وَالْإِفْضَالِ, that you must help your neighbors with the profitability and with the giving abundantly to them, to provide the gifts or to help them in a way that it is an abundant giving. Now, this terminology which has been used, it tells us about the importance of the neighbors that we have, and on top of that, it conveys a message that when we want to give profitability to our neighbors, when we want to give favor to our neighbors, it should be in a way that is considered as an abundant way, that we go a lot, we visit them, for example, and we take a lot of gifts for them. Or maybe we help them in a way that they do not have any need for anything else. Sometimes, you know, we help our neighbors up to the extent they need. Sometimes we help them for a very less amount. And sometimes when we provide help or when we help them, it's in a way that they become free of need. And that's what Imam alayhi salam is also referring. And that's what the Islamic teachings refers when it is said to provide profitability with abundant giving to the neighbors. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of profitability or giving profitability with abandoned giving to the neighbors, or to provide the profitability to the neighbors in a way that they become free of need. And that is what we need to have, because the neighbors are like our family members. The neighbors are like our family members. But on top of that, we must know the limits of the neighbors. There are three types of neighbors. Once we have a neighbor who is politicized, for that it is said that when you have a politicized neighbor, it is only to take care of them because he is living next door to you. On the other hand, the second category is that a neighbor who is a Muslim, and if he is a Muslim, just Muslim, we must take care of him and we must provide help, and we must obviously look after the neighbor. But the third category is that when there is a neighbor who is a Muslim and a mu'min, and on top of that, he is your relative, and if you have a relation with them and they are your neighbors, it is necessary to provide them whatever you can and to look after them in a way that they become free of need. So for the neighbors, we must take care of them in a way that when they're living next to us, we are aware of their condition, and when we are providing them a profitability, when we are giving them some gifts, it should be in a way that they become free of need. And this way we are taking care of them so that the people who are living around us, they feel secure and they feel free of need. And this way we can have a peaceful life in that place where we are living, and we can have peaceful neighbors, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the decades since smallpox vaccination ended, the proportion of people protected against monkeypox has fallen substantially, allowing the virus to spread more easily from animals into humans and from person to person, fueling the risk of a major outbreak. We now present you an article written jointly by Ian Sample and Nicola Davis. The piece is titled, Scientists Say Monkeypox Outbreak Was Waiting to Happen. Scientists say the unprecedented surge in monkeypox cases in the United Kingdom and beyond was an outbreak waiting to happen after the end of global smallpox vaccination more than 40 years ago. The UK Health Security Agency announced a further 14 cases in England on Tuesday, 24th of May, bringing the total to 70, and one further patient in Scotland. No cases have been identified in Wales or Northern Ireland. Routine smallpox vaccination wound down in most countries before 1980, when the World Health Assembly declared the disease eradicated. Because the vaccine also protects against monkeypox, the campaign had kept that disease in check too, notably in regions of Central and Western Africa, where the virus is endemic. In the decades since smallpox vaccination ended, the proportion of people protected against monkeypox has fallen substantially, allowing the virus to spread more easily from animals into humans and from person to person, fueling the risk of a major outbreak. Dr. Romulus Brebon, a researcher at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, said, "This outbreak was really waiting to happen. For example, mathematical modelling by Brebon and his team in 2020 found that in the Democratic Republic of Congo, immunity to monkeypox fell from 85% in the early 1980s to just 60% in 2012. He wrote, at the time, with declining immunity, monkeypox posed an ever-increasing threat for health security. In 2020, the Democratic Republic of Congo had more than 4,000 suspected cases of monkeypox and at least 171 deaths. Dr. Romulus Brebon said, "Our immunity level is almost zero. People aged 50 and above are likely to be immune, but the rest of us are not. So we are very, very susceptible." He believes the outbreak can be contained and said it was an opportunity to propose vaccination campaigns in countries where the virus is endemic. Until this year, only a handful of cases of monkeypox had ever been spotted in the United Kingdom, all linked to travel from Nigeria. Since the first UK case of 2022 was announced on 7th of May, nearly 300 suspected or confirmed cases have come to light in at least 16 countries. The surge in cases has raised questions about whether the monkeypox virus has evolved into a more transmissible form. So far, scientists have found no evidence for this being the case, but researchers are studying the DNA to see if mutations in the virus may have changed its behavior. Genetic studies so far suggest the virus matches strains that reached the United Kingdom, Singapore, and the occupied Palestinian territories in 2018 and 2019. Professor David Heyman, a distinguished fellow at Chatham House's Global Health Programme, said the outbreak appeared more of a chance event, with the virus being amplified once it got into a community of men. Graham Medley, a professor of infectious disease modelling at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, said there was unlikely to be the same explosive growth of infections into the general population that was witnessed with COVID-19. But he said the outbreak could continue for several months, as contact tracing slows but does not stop transmission. He said, "As with COVID, we can expect twists and turns as monkeypox outbreaks continue. At the moment, the transmission chains are mostly within younger men, but there are other settings where there is sufficient contact for monkeypox to spread. The longer the outbreak continues and the higher the prevalence, the more likely the monkeypox will find these other niches." Researchers in Britain have revealed promising yet tentative signs that an antiviral may help to reduce illness from the virus. In a study published in The Lancet Infectious Diseases, 4 of 7 patients diagnosed with monkeypox in the United Kingdom between 2018 and 2021 were given either brincidofovir or tecovirimat, drugs developed to treat smallpox. Findings from the 3 patients given brincidofovir suggest the drug provided little clinical benefit and did not appear to reduce the duration of the illness. However, the 1 patient treated with tecovirimat had a shorter hospital stay and appeared to shed the virus detected by PCR tests for a shorter period of time. Dr. Hugh Adler, the co-author of the study at Liverpool University Hospitals NHS Trust, said that although only 1 patient was involved, the result for tecovirimat was a promising signal. Dr. Hugh Adler said, "Now that we're seeing more cases, unexpectedly, we think it's important to share," adding, "This is the sum total of human experience with these drugs and monkeypox so far. Britain has secured a supply of tecovirimat and is offering a smallpox vaccine to close contacts of people diagnosed with monkeypox to reduce the risk of symptomatic infection and severe illness. Sources suggest an extra 20,000 doses of the vaccine have been ordered to add to the UK stock of 5,000.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the laws related to Amr Ma'ruf and Nahya an al-Munkar, which is the concept of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. It's a couple of programs that we've started talking about the very concept and idea of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And we've started with the concept of, Amr bi Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar, and whether it is obligatory. And also we talked about the conditions for that concept to be obligatory. Sheikh Javid, I'd appreciate it if you have anything to add to the previous, episodes about the concept and the conditions of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the conditions, and of course the last condition which I talked about in the previous episode, was that enjoining should not result in a bad consequence. Mm-hmm. For example, such as the life or the loss of life and the loss of reputation or the loss of money or any other negative consequences which are generally unbearable, mm-hmm. and which are lead to some kind of hardship and difficulty for that individual. So in that case, if it does lead to such consequences, negative consequences, then of course it becomes, it's no longer obligatory. Mm. And of course, in some cases, when you see that, for example, enjoying the good and forbidding the evil leads to such a grave or negative consequence, mm-hmm. that maybe you will end up losing your life, then it becomes haram. It's not permissible, mm-hmm. to take action, because you know that, okay, there are a group of people who have their weapons in their hands, or they have knives, for example. They are very much ready to hurt you.
Yes.
So in that case, you should just simply, go without...
Ignore it.
Yeah, ignore it. Go without doing anything. No,
that's, but sometimes people miscalculate.
You're right.
And misjudge.
Yeah, that's...
For example, you don't know the person, the individual that you want to, in fact, go to and enjoin the good for him, mm-hmm. right? Or prevent him from doing something bad or evil. But suddenly they, take a guard against you then they'll start fighting you.
Well, in that case, you're not to blame. You know, you miscalculated. You're not to blame. Okay, you just thought that it is going to be of some help to those people. You were going to correct them, to remind them.
You had good intentions.
Yeah, you had the good intention, but those people suddenly...
they think it's, I don't know, something like a prevention, for example, or a kind of intervention in their own lives.
In their own lives, you're right. And let me say that according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, he says that one must take the importance of something into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Something, for example, if the obligatory act or if the haram act is of great importance before Allah or in the eye of Allah. For example, like to maintain the life of a group of people, to protect the society or to maintain Islam or protect Islam, mm-hmm. It is highly, important and it is of tremendous importance. Then one should, His Eminence says that we should take the importance of something into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if something is very much critical, it is critical to the life of the society or the protection of the country, just as we see that in the for example, the Iranians fought the Ba'athist regime of Iraq. You mm-hmm. know, they sacrificed their lives. Thousands, of people went to the war front and they sacrificed their lives. It was a kind of, preventing evil.
Yes.
So that was of great importance.
Mm-hmm.
And... sometimes it becomes necessary even to sacrifice your lives, depending on how important the issue is.
Uh-huh, okay.
So there are certain stages which I would like to talk about.
Okay, let's actually postpone it to the next segment of our program, Sheikh Javid, if you agree.
Sure.
So let's have a break, and we'll be back and continue our discussion on that, the concept of enjoying the good and forbidding the evil, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Stay with us.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about Ayatollah Khamenei's views on enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Sheikh Javid, let's just start talking about the stages or the steps of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil.
Well, there are certain steps which we must know, and before we jump into any action to stop evil and to promote virtue, we must be cognizant and well aware of those stages or steps that we must take.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, enjoining begins from your heart, from your intention or mind. By heart enjoining, it is meant to express one's hatred, one's disgust, That is, for example, mukallaf, the duty-bound person, must express his inner hatred mm-hmm. and aversion,
Right.
And disgust for somebody's committing a sinful act or neglecting an obligation, When you show your dissatisfaction or disgust, that could work, and provided that the other individual knows and sees your reaction to something,
mm-hmm.
so that will be enough. If that helps prevent the evil, that's enough. You don't have to go to the next stage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then the second stage is there. Oral enjoining. A duty-bound person must orally enjoin others to do obligatory acts or, forbid haram acts, refrain from doing haram acts.
Mm-hmm.
In this step, of course, if it seems probable that the aim will be achieved through, for example, preaching, advice, or a gentle speech, one should not take a more serious step,
Mm-hmm.
So again, we have to be very careful to follow the degrees or the stages. We should not jump into the harsh step or into practical enjoining,
mm-hmm.
as long as we can do oral enjoining.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if others avoiding a sin or performing an obligation depends on a harsh speech.
Right.
Or threat, one must act accordingly,
Mm-hmm.
If, for example, a gentle speech does not work, then we have to resort to a harsh speech, to threat or mm-hmm. and intimidation and so on and so forth. Then there is a third stage, practical enjoining. By practical enjoining, we mean that one must prevent the offender, the sinner, from committing a sin or avoiding an obligation, by exerting authority and using a physical effort, by taking action, using our hands to prevent someone from doing something. For example, you can, if someone is drinking wine, you can just grab the bottle of wine and throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a practical enjoining. And of course, it has to be noted that at the time of an established Islamic government, the practical enjoining is the duty of the government and not that of individuals, because it's very important that should be an organization or an institution within the Islamic government. And of course, there is one such institution that engages in promoting virtue and spreading virtue and preventing evil. Of course, individuals cannot take the law into their own hands,
mm-hmm.
because there will be chaos, there will be mayhem, there will be, for example, lawlessness.
Yes.
Okay. So it is not permissible for an individual, as long as there is an Islamic institution that's promoting virtue, to take the law into his hand and, of course, and jump into action, preventing physically the people, the sinners, from doing such things. It's the duty of the Islamic government to do
exactly.
so.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much,
Sheikh Javid, for your nice talking and elaboration of some of these legal and jurisprudential statuses of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.